Galtzin gave Tros as the price of his son Ganymedes, because they were the best of all horses under the sun. And my lord Anchises stole a spat of that breed when he put his mares to them without asking leave of Laomedon. They brought him 6 colts in the stable. 4 of them he kept and fed at the stall, 2 he gave to Aeneas, and they can go. If we could get those 2, it would be grand. As they talked together, the others came galloping near, and Pandarus called out, "You are a hardy one, you are a clever one, a worthy son of Tydeus. Sure enough, my shot did not bring you down, my sharp arrow. Now then, I will see whether my spear will have better luck." With these words, he cast his spear and hit Diomedes on the shield. Right through it, the point went and struck the corselet. Then Pandarus shouted, "A hit right through the side, and I don't think you will last long now. Victory for me!" Diomedes answered, undismayed, "A miss, not a hit. But I think you two will never give over till one of you at least shall fall, and give a surfeit of blood to the strong-shielded god of war." Then he threw. Athena guided the point upon the man's nose beside the eye. It ran through his white teeth and cut off the root of the tongue, and the blade came out under his chin. He tumbled out of the car in his rattling armor, gleaming and flashing in the sun. The horses shied, and there his life and courage vanished away. Now Aeneas leapt out with shield and spear to save the body from the spoilers. He bestrode his friend like a strong lion, speared and shield well in front, ready to kill anyone who should face him, and shouting defiance. But Diomedes lifted a large stone, such as 2 men could not lift, as men are now, but he handled it easily by himself. This he crashed down upon the hip of Aeneas, where the thigh turns in the socket, what they call the cup. The jagged stone smashed the cup and burst both the sinews and tore away the skin. The hero fell forward on his knees and leaned with one hand upon the ground. Then black night covered his eyes. And that would have been the death of my lord Aeneas. But his mother, Aphrodite, saw what had happened to her son. She threw her white arms about him and covered him with the fold of her shining robe to shelter him from the blows of any who might wish to kill him. But Sthenelus had not forgotten what Diomedes had told him to do. He left his own horses out of danger, hitching the reins over the handrail. Then he dashed at Aeneas' horses and drove them away to his own people. These he sent back to the camp in charge of Deipolus, his familiar friend, and the nearest to his heart, then quickly got into his own car and galloped after Diomedes. But Diomedes was following Aphrodite, spear in hand. He knew she was a timid goddess, not one of those who lord it in men's battles, not Athena or city-sacking in Io. At last, after a long chase, he caught her, leapt on her, and thrust, and wounded the skin of her soft hand. The spear tore through that incorruptible robe which the graces themselves had made for her, and pierced the flesh just above the palm of her hand. The blood ran out, that immortal blood of the gods, the ichor, which runs in those blessed veins. For they eat no bread and drink no wine, therefore they are bloodless and never die. She shrieked aloud and dropped her son. But Phoebus Apollo picked him up and saved him in a black cloud, so that no enemy could strike him and take his life. Then Diomedes shouted to the goddess, "Away from the battle, you daughter of Zeus! Isn't it enough that you beguile weak women? But if you will visit a battlefield, I think, after this, a battle will make you shiver if you hear only its echoes in the distance." She hastened away, raving in her agony. Iris took her out of the throng as swift as the wind. She was in great pain. The pretty flesh was stained. Soon she found Ares sitting on the left of the battle near a cloud with spear and horses. She fell on her knees, begging and praying her brother for the loan of his horses. "Brother, dear, do help me and lend me your team. I want to go home to Olympus. This hurts me too much, this wound. A mortal man did it, Tydides, and he's quite ready now to fight Father Zeus himself." Ares let her have the horses, and she climbed into the car, much distressed. Iris followed and took the reins, and touched up the horses, and they flew with a will. They soon reached the heights of Olympus, safe at home. Then Iris loosed the horses and gave them their ambrosial fodder. But Aphrodite threw herself on her mother's lap. Dione took her daughter in her arms and stroked her with her hand and said, "My dear child, which of the sons of heaven has treated you like this, you poor innocent, as if you had been caught doing something naughty?" Aphrodite answered, and where were her smiles now? "Oh, my wound! Diomedes hit me, that bully, because I was trying to save my own son Aeneas, my darling favorite. This war of Trojans and Achaeans has become a war of Achaeans against gods." Dione said, "Make the best of it, my love. Be patient, even if it hurts. Many of us Olympians have had to make the best of what men do, and we have brought much trouble upon one another. Ares made the best of it when Otos and Ephialtes made him their prisoner. They shut him up in a brazen jar for 13 months. Indeed, that would have been the end of Ares, the greedy fighter, if their stepmother Erebea had not brought the news to Hermes, and Hermes stole him away when he was already in great distress from his cruel prison. Hera made the best of it when mighty Heracles shot her in the right breast with a 3-barbed arrow, and she had to bear pain intolerable. Hades the Tremendous made the best of it when that very same man, the son of Zeus Almighty, you know, shot him in Pylos among the dead men, and the sharp arrow hurt him sorely. He went up to Olympus in his trouble, pierced with cruel pains, for the arrow had run through his shoulder and distressed him. Dian put on a plaster of soothing simples and made it well, for Hades could not die. Oh, that hard, violent man, that worker of evil, who distressed the Olympian gods with his arrows. And now you. But Athena set the man on you. Silly fool, he has not sense enough to know that he who fights with the immortals has not long to live. He will never come home from the war. His children will not climb on his knees and daddy him. Then let this Diomedes take care. He may be very powerful, but a stronger foe than you may meet him. One day his loving wife may waken the household with lamentations when she misses her wedded husband, the best man of the Achaean host. So much for the queenly Aegialeia, so much for Diomedes, who knows so well how to manage a horse." While she spoke, she was wiping away the ichor from the wounded wrist with both her hands. The arm grew whole. The throbbing pains were assuaged. Athena and Hera were looking on, and now they began to tease Zeus Cronides with their raillery. Athena led off. "Father Zeus, will you be angry if I say something? I feel sure Cypris has been tempting some Achaean woman to join the Trojans, whom she loves now so desperately. She must have been fondling one of their pretty frocks, and scratched her little hand on a golden brooch." He smiled at that, the great father of gods and men, and calling Aphrodite to him, he said, "My dear child, war is not your department. Leave all that to Ares and Athena, and busy yourself with marriage and love." While they were talking like this together, the bold Diomedes had leapt upon Aeneas, although he perceived that Apollo was holding his arms above the man. He did not trouble about the great god, but wanted only to kill Aeneas and strip off his armor. 3 times he leapt at the man to kill him. 3 times Apollo beat back his shield. But when he came on the 4th time, like a devil, Apollo shouted at him with a loud cry, "Beware, Diomedes! Forbear, Diomedes! Do not try to put yourself on a level with the gods. That is too high for a man's ambition. The immortal gods are one race. Men that walk upon the earth are another." Tydides moved back a step when he heard these words, fearing the wrath of Apollo shoot afar, and Apollo took Aeneas away from the crowd and set him down in Pergamos within his own temple. Then Leto and Artemis healed him and made much of him in the great sanctuary, while Apollo's silver bow created a phantom like Aeneas, in armor like his, and let Achaeans and Trojans batter one another upon their leathern shields and fringe-fluttering bucklers. Then Phoebus Apollo called out to Ares, "Oh, Ares, Ares, you men's bane, you bloodthirsty fort-stormer, go in now, will you, and drag out this man from the battle, this Diomedes, who is ready to fight against Father Zeus himself. First he tackled Cypris and wounded her wrist, and then he made her leap at me like a devil." He stepped back and took his seat on the citadel, and dreadful Ares went into the Trojan ranks, rallying them to the fight. He took the form of Acamas, the Thracian captain, and called loudly to the sons of Priam, "Now, my young princes, how long will you let the Achaeans kill and kill? Will you wait till they assault the city gates? There lies a man whom we honored as high as Hector himself, Aeneas Anchises' son. Come on, let us bring our good comrade out of the turmoil." Then Sarpedon cried out in reproach, "Where is your old courage, Hector? I think you said you could hold the city without a crowd of allies, alone, with your brothers and the rest of your family. But I don't see any of them now. I don't notice them here. No, they are like a pack of dogs shrinking away from a lion. We have to do the fighting. We, your allies. I am one of your allies, and I came from far away. Yes, Lycia is far away, beside the eddying Xanthos. There I have left my own wife and little boy. There I have left all the goods I have, which all the have-nots covet. All the same, I lead my Lycians. I am ready to fight any man, though there is nothing of mine here for the Achaeans to harry and lift. And there you stand. You don't even tell your people to defend their wives. A fine haul your enemies will have to play with, like fish caught in the meshes of a net. They will soon sack that noble city of yours. It should be your care night and day to make yourself pleasant to your allies. Go down on your knees and beg them to hold their ground firmly, and then you would have no reproach." That stung Hector. He jumped out of his car and went everywhere, shaking his two spears, rallying all to the fight. Now they turned their faces towards the enemy. The Achaeans stood firm, and battle was joined again. The chariots ran wheeling about, the horses' hooves beat up the dust, which drove in a great cloud to the brazen sky and covered the Achaeans with white. The whole place was like some great threshing floor, when the farmhands are winnowing and throwing up their shovelfuls into the wind. Golden Demeter divides corn and chaff, and the chaff is blown away into white heaps. So they fought with might and main, and Ares covered the battle with darkness to help the Trojans. He was here and there and everywhere doing his best for the Trojans, as Apollo had told him to do when he saw that Athena was gone, for she had been helping the Danians. Apollo himself brought Aeneas out of the sanctuary and made him well and strong again. Then Aeneas joined his friends. Very glad they were to see him alive and hearty with all his limbs, but they asked no questions. They had quite enough to do with Silverbow and bloodthirsty Ares, and Discord, who gave them no peace. The Danians were kept hard at it by Aeas Big and Aeas Little, by Odysseus and Diomedes, but they needed no driving. Trojans might storm and Trojans might strike. They knew no fear. They stood immovable, like the clouds which Cronion masses upon the mountain tops in fine weather, while all the blustering winds are asleep, Boreas and the other winds which scatter the dark clouds with their whistling blasts. There stood the Danians, and faced the enemy immovable, and Atrides was among them with cheering words, "Show yourselves men, my friends, and keep a stout heart. Think of your honor. With all men's eyes upon you, it is a shame to be a coward. He that fights and will not run may live to see another son. He that runs and will not fight is bound to die, and serves him right." He cast a spear quickly and hit the front man, Deicoon Pergasides, by the side of Aeneas. The Trojans honored him equally with Priam's own sons, because he was always quick to push to the front. The spear went through his shield and ran through the belt into the belly. The man fell with a thud under his rattling armor. Then Aeneas struck down the two sons of Diocles, Crethon and Orsilochus, strong men both. Their father lived in Phera, a man of wealth, and sprung for Alpheus, the river god. This river flows through the Pylian country. The god begat Orsilochus, who was king over a great people. Orsilochus begat Diocles, a stout warrior himself, and so were his twin sons. These two, when they grew up to manhood, sailed for Ilios with the fleet, to avenge the wrong of Agamemnon and Menelaus, and there they found their deaths. So one might see a couple of young lions bred in the mountain forests, which ravage the folds and carry off cattle and sheep, until they are killed at last by the hand of man. And here the hands of Aeneas brought them low, and they lay like two fallen fir trees. Menelaus saw them fall. He was sorry for the lads and strode through the press, shaking his spear. Ares himself had made him angry because he wished Aeneas to kill him. But Nestor's son Antilochus caught sight of the king. He was anxious that nothing should happen to him, and so they might waste all their labors. And he came up just as the two were face to face, ready to begin, and stood beside him. When Aeneas saw two instead of one, he did not wait, although he was no mean warrior. The two dragged away the dead bodies and handed the poor devils over to their people, and then returned to the fight. There they killed Polymenes, the Paphlagonian captain. Menelaus struck him, standing with a spear thrust through the collarbone. Antilochus cast a stone at his driver, Mydon Antimniades, as he was managing the horses in his chariot, and struck his elbow. He dropped the reins, and Antilochus, leaping upon him, drove his sword through the man's temple. He rolled out, gasping, and tumbled half over with head and shoulder dangling in the dust. There he stuck a long time, for the dust was deep, until the struggling horses kicked him out into the dust. Then Antilochus whipped them up and drove them to the rear. Hector spied them across the ranks and made for them with shouts, while a strong body of his men followed. Ares and Anio were in front, she carrying the merciless din of war, Ares wielding a monstrous spear and showing himself now before Hector, now behind. Diomede shuddered when he saw Ares. As a man, after a long march, stops helpless when he sees a furious river foaming and flowing along and leaps back, so Diomedes leapt back and cried out to his people, "How could we admire Hector, my friends, and call him hero and champion? There is always some god beside him to keep him safe. See, there is Ares now in the shape of a mortal man. Keep your faces to the foe and move to the rear. We must not think of pitched battle against gods." As he spoke, the Trojans closed up. Then Hector killed two good fighting men in one chariot, Menesthes and Anchialus. But Big Aeus saw them fall. He could not leave them there, so he made a stand beside them, and with his spear he struck down Amphius, Selagus' son. This was a man rich in cattle and rich in corn, whose home was at Paphos, but fate had brought him to fight for Priam and his sons. Aeus struck him in the lower belly through the belt. When he fell, Aeus ran up to seize his arms, but he was met with a shower of spears, most of them falling on his shield. He set one foot on the body and pulled out his own spear, but he could not strip off the body armor in that shower of spears. He was afraid he might be surrounded by such a crowd of enemies strongly armed. They pushed him away from them, strong though he was, and he retired, staggering. So the turmoil of the battle went on. One fine, strong man, Tlepolemus, Heracles' son, was driven by hard fate against Prince Sarpedon. There the two men stood face to face, son and grandson of Zeus' cloud-gatherer, and Tlepolemus said the first words. "Sarpedon, you are a high counselor among your own people, but why must you be skulking here, an unwarlike fellow like you? They lie who say you are a son of Zeus, for you are far behind those who were sons of Zeus in former times. How different was the great Heracles, my father, all-daring, lion-heart. He came to this place about Laomedon's horses with only 6 ships and a few men, and sacked the city of Ilios and made her streets a desert. But you are a coward heart, and your people are dwindling away. I don't think you will be much help to the Trojans after your journey from Lycia, even if you are very strong. But you shall be vanquished by me and go to the gates of Hades." Sarpedon answered, "Tlepolemus, that great man, destroyed Ilios because of the folly of Laomedon, who mocked him after honest service, and refused to give the horses which he had traveled so far to earn. As for you, I declare death and destruction shall be yours in this place. You shall be vanquished by my spear. You shall give glory to me and your soul to Hades." As he spoke, Tlepolemus lifted his ashen spear, and both let fly at the same moment. Sarpedon struck his man in the neck. The cruel point ran right through, and dark night covered his eyes. The other spear eagerly pierced the left thigh of Sarpedon, grazing the bone, but his father still kept his life safe. Sir Peyton was carried out of the battle by his friends. The spear, dragging along, gave him great pain, but no one noticed it or thought of drawing it out to let him stand on his feet. They were in great haste, and had too much to do in looking after him. On the other side, Tlepolemus was carried away by the Achaeans. Odysseus was furious to see this, though he was a patient man. He was in two minds whether he should go on in pursuit of Sarpedon or kill more Lycians instead. But it was not ordained that Odysseus should slay the son of Zeus Thunderer, and Athena turned his mind to the Lycian crowd. There he killed Cyrenos, Alastor, Chromios, Alcandros, Halios, Noemon, Pitinus, and more he would have killed, but Hector saw him and hastened to the spot, bringing terror with him. Sarpedon was glad indeed when he came near, and called out piteously, "Priamides, my friend, don't let them get hold of me, help me, and then let me die in your city, since it seems I was never to return to my native land, or to make my wife happy, and my little boy." But Hector passed by without a word. He was mad to drive the enemy back and to kill many. So Sarpedon was carried on and laid under a noble oak tree, and there his friend Pelagon pushed out the spear from his thigh. Sarpedon fainted dead away, but he came to again as the north wind breathed upon him and brought life back to his fainting spirit. The Argives, before Ares and Hector, neither turned about nor could they hold their ground, but they moved backwards, facing the foe, when they found Ares to be with their enemies. And who was first slain and who last by Hector and brazen Ares? Teuthras, and then Orestes, Aetolian Trechus, and Oenomaus, Helenus Sinopides, and Oresbios in his flashing kilt, who used to live in Hyle near the Cephisian lake, husbanding his wealth, near neighbor to the other Boeotians in their land of plenty. But now Hera saw the Argives getting the worst of the battle, and she called out to Athena in plain words, "Bless us all, Atritone. Aren't you the daughter of all-triumphant Zeus? And is our word to go for nothing? We promised Menelaus that he should destroy Ilios, and are we going to let Ares ruin everything in this mad way? Let us see if our help can mend matters." Athena was willing enough. Then Hera ran about, harnessing the horses and putting on their golden frontlets. Hera herself, the queen of heaven, daughter of mighty Cronos. Hebe fitted the wheels to the car, brazen wheels with 8 spokes, at each end of an iron axle tree. Each had a fellow of gold incorruptible, with a brazen tire fitted all round, wonderful things. Each had a nave of silver turning about the end of the axle tree. The body was of gold and silver bands braided tightly, and there was a handrail curving round on each side. The pole in front was of silver. On the end of this Hebe fastened the golden yoke and hung the golden neck straps. Lastly, Hera led the horses under the yoke, hot for the battle. Then Athena slipped off her soft linen robe, which she had made and embroidered with her own hands. It fell on her father's floor, and she put on the tunic of Zeus Cloud-Gatherer and arrayed herself for the weeping work of war. Over her shoulders she cast the tasseled goatskin cape, an awful thing, for panic is wreathed about it. Discord is there, valor is there, blood-curdling shock is there. And there is the Gorgon's head, that awful prodigy, awful and horrible, the sign and wonder of Zeus Almighty. Upon her head she put a helmet with 2 horns and 4 bosses, all of gold, and decorated with the champions of 100 cities. She set her foot in the fiery car, grasping the spear, so heavy, huge, and strong, with which when she is angry she vanquishes battalions of fighting men, a true daughter of her mighty sire. Hera quickly touched up the horses. The celestial gates opened of themselves, groaning upon their hinges, those gates which the seasons used to guard, for they have charge of Olympus and high heaven to close or unclose the solid cloud. There, through the gates, they drove the obedient horses. They found Cronion sitting alone upon the topmost peak of Olympus. Then Hera drew up and said to him, "Father Zeus, have you nothing to say to these violent doings of Ares? What a mort of men he's been killing, wiping out the whole Achaean nation, slapdash, most improper, I declare. Cypris and Apollo Silverbow just enjoying themselves quite at their ease after setting on this idiot who won't keep the rules. Father Zeus, will you be angry with me if I beat him well and chase him out of the field? Zeus, cloud-gatherer, answered, Go along, do. Send Athena on the hunt. She knows how to make him smart. Hera lost no time, but whipped up the horses, and away they flew with a will between earth and the starry sky. One leap of those whinnying thoroughbreds takes them as far as a watcher on the mountains can see into the dim distance over the waves. On the plain of Troy, where the two rivers Simosis and Scamandros join their streams, Hera pulled up and loosed the horses, and left them unseen in a thick cloud. Simois made a crop of ambrosia grow up for them to graze upon. Then the two goddesses scuttled along like a pair of pigeons to the rescue of their friends, the Argives. They found Diomedes in the midst of a throng of the best fighting men who pressed close about him, furious as roaring lions or wild boars in all their strength. There Hera stood still, and taking the shape of Stentor, that great heart with the trumpet voice who could shout as loud as any 50 men, she cried out, Shame on you, Argives! You are a disgrace to your good looks. Handsome is that handsome does. When Achilles showed himself in the field, not a Trojan would come outside the gates. They were too much afraid of that man's mighty spear. And now they have left Troy far behind, and here they assault you beside your own ships. So she kindled a fiery temper in each one. But Athena leapt to the place where Diomedes was among the chariots, cooling the wound of the arrow. He was holding up the broad strap of his shield and wiping away the blood and sweat from his weary arm, for he was in great distress. The goddess took hold of his horse's yoke and said, Ah, you are not much like your father, Tydeus. He was a small man, but a fighter. I told him myself not to fight and not to show off that time when he was sent alone into Thebes to parley with the Cadmeans. I told him to feast away and sit quiet. But he had a spirit, then and always, and he challenged the young men and beat them all. But you, I stand by you and take care of you and bid you to fight with all my heart, but perhaps you are tired out with your impetuous assaults. Or can it be that you are afraid, that you are no son of Tydeus Onides? Diomedes answered, I know you, divine daughter of Zeus Almighty, so I will tell you the truth with all my heart. I am not afraid, I shrink from nothing, but I still remember your commands. I was not to fight with any of the blessed gods at all, except Aphrodite, but if she came into the battle I was to give her a wound. That is why I now retreat, and why I have gathered all these men here. For I know Ares, master of the battlefield. Athena said, Diomedes, you are a man after my own heart. Don't be afraid of Ares or any other immortal. You shall see. I will be with you. Drive straight for Ares. Hit him hard. Don't bow down to Ares, that mad, furious creature, that graven image of wickedness, Mr. Facing All Ways. Yesterday he stood up in front of Hera and me and vowed he would fight the Trojans and help the Argives. And now he is on the Trojan side and forgets all about that. So saying, she pulled back Sthenelus and pushed him out of the car. Out he jumped in a jiffy, and she got in beside Diomedes in great excitement. How the axle tree groaned under the weight, for it carried an awful goddess and a mighty man. Athena grasped whip and reins, and away went the horses straight for Ares. At that moment he was stripping the armor from Periphas, covered with blood. Periphas, Ochesius' son, a huge man, the first champion of the Aetolians. But Athena put on the hiding cap of Hades, for she did not want Ares to see her. But Ares did see Diomedes, and as soon as he saw him, he left the dead man lying where he fell and went straight for Diomedes. He came up on the off side and let fly with his spear over yoke and reins, but Athena caught it as it flew past and sent it harmless over the car. Diomedes followed up with a thrust at Ares, and Athena drove the spear straight into his belly where the kilt is girdled. The point ran in and tore the flesh, and Diomedes pulled the spear back. Then Ares roared like a trumpet, as loud as 9,000 men could shout, aye, 10,000 men in the turmoil of battle. Trojans and Achaeans alike trembled to hear the roar of the insatiate god of war. What was this Diomedes now beheld? Sometimes, after sultry heat, a furious whirlwind arises, and you may see a great black mass blowing up from the clouds. That is what Diomedes beheld now. And it was Ares, blowing up through the clouds into high heaven. Instantly he was in Olympus, where the gods do dwell. Down he sat by the side of Zeus in a miserable state, and showed him the immortal blood running from his wound, and said in a dismal tone, without mincing words, "Father Zeus, have you nothing to say to these violent doings? We gods have to put up with the most terrible things from one another if we do a good turn to a man, and we're all against you, for you begat that crazy girl, curse her, who has always some mischief in hand. All the rest of our family obey you. We submit, every one of us. But that girl, you don't care what she says or what she does. Indeed, you set her on, for she is your own child, confound her. Now, see what she has done. Put up this young bully Diomedes to run amok against the immortal gods. First he wounds Cypris on the wrist, then he is on me like a devil. But I got away thanks to my quick heels. I don't know how long I might have been there, most uncomfortable among the damned corpses. Or if I lived, I should be a cripple from those spear prods." Zeus' cloud-gatherer frowned at him and said, "Don't sit there whimpering, you facing always. I won't have it. I hate you more than any other god alive. All you care for is discord and battle and fighting. You are just like your mother with that stubborn, insufferable temper. It's all I can do to control her without using my hands. It is some plan of hers, I am sure, which brought you into all this. However, I will not let you suffer any longer, for you are my son, after all. But if any other god had begotten such a nuisance, you should have been down below the heavenly host long ago." Then he sent for Paeon, the healer. Paeon put on a plaster of soothing simples and made him well, for he was not mortal. The wound healed over at once, just as you might drop fig juice into a bowl of milk and it curdles as you stir. Hebe bathed him and dressed him up smart, and he took his seat beside Zeus Cronion, quite happy and cheerful. Soon Hera and Athena returned home, Hera the friend of Argos, and Athena an ever-present help in time of trouble, as soon as they had put an end to the murderous exploits of Ares, the enemy of mankind. Book 6. How Paris Was Brought Back into Battle, and How Hector Parted from Andromache. So the great conflict was left to the Trojans and Achaeans. This way and that way the battle moved over the plain between Simois and the estuary, as the two armies fought and struggled together. Telamonius was the first to show a gleam of hope for his side when he broke into a Trojan battalion by striking down Acamas. This was a great, strong man, Acamas, Eusorus' son, the best man of the Thracians. He is pierced through the helmet into the bone of his forehead, and darkness covered his eyes. Next, Diomedes killed Exilus Teuthranides, whose home was in Arisbe. He was one wealthy and loved by all, for he lived near the high road and entertained all who came. But none of all those was there that day to stand before him and shield him from death. No, they were both killed. He and his man Calisius, who drove his car, both passed below the earth. Euryalus brought down Drusus and Opheltius. Then he went after Esepus and Pedasus, both sons of Bucolion, by the naiad nymph Barbaria. Bucolion was the son of Laomedon, his eldest son, but it was a secret love. He also lay with his nymph while tending the sheep, and she bore him the twin sons who were slain and despoiled by Euryalus Misistiades. Astyalus was killed by Polypetes, Odysseus killed Pedaites and Teucrus Eretaon. Nestor's son Antilochus brought down Ableros, and King Agamemnon killed Elatos,
whose home was on the banks of broad Satnioeus in Pedasus on the hill.
Leotos caught Philocos in flight, and Eurypylus stripped Melanthios. Then Menelaus took Adrestus alive, for his horses, in headlong flight, ran against a tamarisk branch and broke off the end of their pole. The horses galloped towards the city, among a crowd of runaways. The master was rolled out over the wheel and fell on his face in the dust. Menelaus was beside him, spear in hand, and Adrestus clasped his knees and prayed for his life.
"Mercy, my lord king, and you shall have a good ransom. There is plenty of treasure in my father's house, bronze and gold and wrought iron. My father would gladly give a rich ransom to hear that I am alive in your camp."
Menelaus was willing to agree, and he was just going to send him back, when Agamemnon came running up and called out loudly,
"Don't be so soft, Menelaus. What do you care for them, man? Have you been so well treated by the Trojans? Then let no one escape death at our hands. Not the boy in his mother's womb. Spare not even him, but let all perish together out of Ilios, unlamented and unnoted."
Thus he changed his brother's mind, as was right and proper. Menelaus pushed the man away, and Agamemnon thrust him through the side. He fell backwards, and the king set his foot on him and drew out the spear. Then Nestor called out in a loud voice,
"Friends and Danians, you are the servants of Ares, and no one must linger and throw himself on spoils. Our business is not to go back to the camp laden, but to kill. Then you can strip the bodies lying dead and get all that afterwards at your leisure."
So they fought on with fury, and the Trojans would have returned to their Ilios cowed and defeated. But for Helenus Priamides, the great prophet of birds, he said to Aeneas and Hector, "The chief burden lies on you too, Hector and Aeneas. Trojans and Lycians look to you because you are the best man for every enterprise in council or in the field, to fight or to provide. Then make a stand here. Go up and down and keep the men away from the gates, or they will run for it and throw themselves into the women's arms and leave the victory to our enemies. Once you have got the ranks in order, we will stand our ground and fight, weary as we are, for we cannot help it. Then you, Hector, go into the city and tell our mother to collect the older women into Athena's temple upon the citadel. Let her open the doors of the holy house and lay on Athena's knees the finest and largest robe she has in her stores, the one she prizes most of all, and let her promise to offer in the temple 12 yearling heifers that have never felt the goad. Only let the goddess pity our town and the wives and little children of Troy. Let her hold back Tydeus' son from sacred Ilios, that wild warrior, that strong contriver of defeat, whom I declare to be the mightiest champion of the enemy. Not even Achilles was so terrible, although he is the son of a goddess, as they say. This man is all madness, and no one can match him." Hector leapt out of the car at his brother's call. Shaking his spears, he went up and down, cheering and encouraging his men and rallying them to the fight. They turned at last and faced their adversaries. Then the Achaeans gave way and ceased their killing. Some god must have come down from heaven, they thought, to help the Trojans when they saw them rally. And Hector cried in a loud voice,
"Brave men of Troy! Noble allies and friends, be men, and hold your own stoutly, while I make my way into the city, and tell our elders and counselors and our wives to offer prayers to the powers above and vow a solemn sacrifice."
With these words he left them, and as he marched, the black shield slung behind him struck its rim upon his ankles and his neck. Into the space between the armies came out Glaucus, the son of Hippolochus, and Diomedes, Tydeus' son, hot for a fight. But as soon as they were close enough, Diomedes spoke first.
"Who are you, noble sir? Of all men in the world, I have never seen you before in the battlefield, but now here you are in front of the whole host, bold enough to face my long spear. Unhappy are they whose sons will face my anger. But if you are some god come down from heaven, I had rather not fight against the gods of heaven.
Even Dryas' son, that strong man Lycurgus, did not last long after he challenged the gods of heaven. He once drove the nurses of mad Dionysus over the sacred Nicene Mount. They all threw away their holy wands when Lycurgus beat them with an ox goad, and Dionysus ran away and dived into the sea, where Thetis received him in her arms, all terrified, for the man had frightened him out of his wits. Then the gods were made angry in their life of peace, and Cronion struck the man blind. He did not live long after he had made himself an enemy of the immortal gods, and I had rather not fight against the gods, blessed be their name. But if you are a mortal, and one of those who eat the fruits of the field, come here, and you shall soon be caught in the bonds of destruction.
Glaucus answered, undismayed,
"Proud son of Tydeus, why do you ask my name and generation? The generations of men are like the leaves of the forest. Leaves fall when the breezes blow. In the springtime, others grow. As they go and come again, so upon the earth do men. But if it is your pleasure to learn such a thing as that, and to know the generations of our house, which indeed many men know, there is a city, Ephyra, in a nook of Argos, the land of horses, and there lived Sisyphus, the cleverest man ever born, Sisyphus Eolides. He had a son, Glaucus, and Glaucus was father of the incomparable Bellerophontes. The gifts of the gods to him were handsome looks and noble manhood. But Prytos plotted mischief against him and drove him from the land of Argos, for he was the stronger, and Zeus had subdued the land under his scepter. Now the wife of Prytos, the lady Antea, was mad after him and wanted his love in secret. But she could not persuade Bellerophontes, being as he was a chaste man with an honorable heart. So she came to Prytos with a lying tale. "Prytos," she said, "kill Bellerophontes, or die yourself. He tried to take me by violence." The king was angry to hear this tale. Kill the man he would not, for he thought that an impious thing. But he sent him to Lycia with a dangerous token. He gave him a folded tablet with a message scratched on it in deadly signs, and bade him show it to his good father that he might be put to death. He travelled to Lycia then with the gods to guide him, and in Lycia by Xanthos River the king of that broad realm entertained him generously for 9 days and killed 9 oxen. Not until the 10th day dawned did he question him, and asked to see any token that he brought from Prytos. When he received the fatal token, first he asked Bellerophontes to kill the ravening Chimera. This creature came of divine stock with nothing of man, lion in front, serpent behind, she-goat in the middle, and her breath was blazing fire. Bellerophontes slew her, encouraged by signs and omens from heaven. In the second place he fought against the redoubtable Solomons. That was the hardest fight he ever fought against men, so he said. Thirdly, he destroyed those manlike women, the Amazons. But when he was on his way back, the king wove another cunning plot. He chose the best fellows out of all the country and set them in ambush. But not one of them ever returned home, for Bellerophontes killed them all. So the king saw at last that he was a true son of the Godhead. Accordingly, he kept him there and gave him his own daughter and half of all his royal honor. The Lycian people allotted him the finest estate in the land, orchards and farms for his use. His wife bore him 3 children, Isandros and Hippolochus and Laodamia. Zeus lay with Laodamia, and she bore him a son, Sarpedon, the warrior prince. But when at the end Bellerophontes gave offense to the gods, he became a lonely wanderer on the Ilian plain, eating out his heart and shunning the paths of men. His son Isandros was killed by Ares when fighting against the Solomons. His daughter was killed by Artemis in anger. Hippolochus was my father, and I am his son. He sent me to Troy and commanded me strictly always to be first and foremost in the field and not to disgrace my fathers, who were first and best, both in Ephyra and in broad Lycia. There you have my lineage and the blood, which is my boast.
Diomedes was delighted with this speech. He planted his spear in the ground and said in a friendly tone, "I declare you are my family friend from a long way back. Ennius once entertained the incomparable Bellerophontes in his house and kept him there for 20 days. When they parted, they exchanged gifts of friendship. Ennius gave a girdle bright with crimson, Bellerophontes a double cup of gold. It was there, in my house, when I came away. But Tydeus I do not remember, for I was only a little tot when he left me, at the time when the Achaean army perished before Thebes. So I am your friend and host in Argos, and you are mine when I go to Lycia. Let us avoid each other if we happen to meet. There are plenty of Trojans and Trojan allies for me to kill, if God grants me to catch them, and plenty of Achaeans for you to spoil, if you can. Let us exchange armor and show the world that we are family friends." They both dismounted and clasped hands and swore friendship. Then Zeus Cronides sent Glaucus clean out of his wits, for he gave his armor in exchange to Diomedes Tydeides, golden for brazen, the price of 100 oxen for 9. When Hector got to the oak tree at the Seian gates, the women ran crowding round, asking news of husbands and brothers, sons and friends. He exhorted them each and all to make their prayer to heaven, but sorrows hung over many. Then Hector went to Priam's noble palace, with its portals and galleries of polished stone. There were 50 chambers built of stone standing side by side, where the sons of Priam slept beside their wives. His daughters and their husbands had 12 roof chambers of stone standing in a row on the opposite side of the courtyard. Here his gracious mother met him, leading Laodice, the most beautiful of her daughters. She clasped his hand and said, "Why have you left the battle, my boy? They must be pressing you hard, those accursed invaders, and you thought you might lift up your hands in prayer to Zeus from our citadel. Just wait a bit, and let me bring you some wine. Pour a libation to Father Zeus and all gods, and then it will do you good to have a drink yourself. You're tired out with defending your friends, poor dear. When a man is tired out, a drop of wine will make him stout." Hector answered, "No wine for me, my dear mother. You will cripple me and make me forget that I must fight. And I dare not pour a libation to Zeus with unwashen hands. It is quite impossible to offer prayers to Cronian Thundercloud, bespattered like this in blood and mud. You must approach Athena yourself. Gather all the older women and go to her temple with your burnt offering. Take the finest and largest robe you have in your store, the one you prize most, and lay it upon Athena's knees. Promise to sacrifice 12 yearling heifers that have never felt the goad, if only she will have compassion upon the wives and children of Troy. If only she will hold off the son of Tydeus from our sacred city, that wild warrior, that strong contriver of defeat. I leave you, then, to visit Athena's temple. Now I must find Paris and see if he will listen to me. If only the earth would swallow him up, a great trouble the Olympian bred in him for Troy and for proud Priam and the sons of Priam. If I could once see that man go down into Hades, I would say that my heart had forgotten how to grieve." The queen called to her servants and sent them through the city, summoning the older women. She herself went down into her vaulted storeroom, where she kept robes embroidered by the women of Sidon, which Alexandros had brought from Sidon when he went on that voyage across the sea, and came back with royal Helen as his bride. She chose one of these for Athena, a great spread of the finest needlework, shining like a star, which lay under the rest. Bearing this, she led the great company of women to Athena's temple upon the citadel. The gates were opened by the priestess, Cisius' daughter, and Antino's wife, the handsome Theano. All cried aloud the women's Alleluia, lifting up their hands. Theano took the robe and laid it on the knees of the goddess, and then she offered her prayer and vow. "Queen Athena, goddess divine,
Savior of our city, do thou break the spear of Diomedes and strike him to the ground before the Scaean gates. Then we will sacrifice to thee in this temple 12 yearling heifers that never felt the goad, if only thou wilt have compassion upon our town and the wives and little children of Troy. So the priestess prayed, but Athena refused her prayer. Meanwhile, Hector had made his way to the mansion of Alexandros, a fine place built by the best workmen in the land. Hall and women's room and courtyard, it stood on the citadel next door to Priam and Hector. He entered, holding his great spear, 11 cubits long, with a bright blade of bronze made fast with a golden ferrule. He found Alexandros in his wife's room, handling his shield and corselet and fingering his bow. Helen was sitting there with her women and seeing about their work. Hector said to him reproachfully, "My good man, you should not be sulking here. Men are falling in the fight outside our walls. War and battle are blazing round the city for your sake. You would be the first to attack anyone else you might see shirking his part. Up, man, or soon fire will warm up the place." Paris answered, "You are right to reproach me, Hector, quite right indeed. But let me tell you this, I give you my word that I was not sulking. It is not bad temper keeps me here, but simply a bitter heart. Just now my wife has been trying to persuade me with gentle words and driving me back to the battle. I think it will be better so myself. Victory chops and changes. Just wait a bit and I will put on my armor. Or go on, and I will follow. I think I shall catch you up." Hector answered nothing, but Helen said warmly, "Brother dear, I am ashamed. I shudder at myself. I can do nothing but evil. I wish a whirlwind had carried me off to the mountains on the day that I was born, or thrown me into the roaring sea. I wish the waves had swept me away before all this was done. But since the gods ordained it so, I wish I had been mated with a better man, one who could feel the contempt and indignation of the world. But this man is unstable and ever shall be. Some day I think this fault will find him out. But do come in now, brother, come in and sit down. I know your heart is most heavy with this world of trouble about us. All for my shame and his infatuation. Indeed, Zeus has laid a cruel fate upon us, to be a byword for generations to come." Hector answered, "Don't ask me to sit, Helen. I thank you all the same, my dear, but I must not stay. They miss me outside, and I must go and do my part. Just keep this man up to the mark. Let him make haste himself and catch me up before I go out of the gates, for I am going home first for one look at my wife and my little boy. I don't know if I shall ever see them again. It may be God's will to lay me low by the enemy's hand." So he took his leave and went on to his own house. But he did not find Andromache there, for she was already upon the battlements with her boy and a servant, weeping in her sorrow. Hector, when he found she was not within, stood at the door and said to the maids, "Be so good as to tell me where your mistress has gone. To one of my sisters, or to my good sisters, or to Athena's temple, where the women are making supplication?" The housekeeper said, "No, sir, not to any of the family, nor to Athena's, where the women are all gone to offer their supplication. To tell the truth, she has gone up on the walls, because she heard that our people were in danger and the enemy were getting the best of it. She has just gone off in a great hurry, like one distracted, and the nurse carrying the boy." So Hector went back by the same way along the streets, till he reached the Scaean gates, by which he meant to go out into the plain, and there his precious wife came running to meet him. Andromache was the daughter of Eetion, the Cilician king, and her home was in Thebe, below the forest of Placos. She came to meet him, and the nurse followed, with the boy in her bosom, quite a little child, cheerful and merry, their little Hector, the tiny champion of Troy, like a shining star whom they dearly loved. Hector called him Scamandrios, but to others he was Astyanax, his gracious majesty. For Hector was the sole saving help of the city.
The father smiled quietly as he looked at his boy. But Andromache stood by his side with tears running down her cheeks and caught his hand fast while she said, "My dearest, how can you do it? Your courage will be your death. Have you no pity for your baby boy or your unhappy wife, who will soon be your widow? Soon they will all rush upon you and kill you. And if I lose you, it would be better for me to go down into my grave. There will be no more comfort for me if you are taken, but only sorrow. I have no father and no mother now. My father was slain by Achilles. He laid waste my home, Thebe, with its lofty towers. He killed Eetion, though he did not despoil him, for he thought that a wicked thing. He burnt him with his armor and raised a barrow upon him, and the divine Oreads of the mountains planted elm trees round about. My 7 brothers all went down to Hades in one day, for that terrible Achilles killed them all amid their cattle and sheep. My mother, who was queen in that place, he brought away a prisoner with the other spoil. He set her free for a heavy ransom, but Artemis Archeris shot her in her father's house. So you are my father and my mother, Hector. You are my brother. You are my loving husband. Then pity me and stay here behind the walls. Do not make your boy an orphan and your wife a widow, but post your men by the fig tree, where the wall may be scaled most easily, where the wall is open to assault. 3 attacks there have been already in great strength, Eos and the other Eos, then Idomeneus, then the 2 kings with Diomedes, whether it be some diviner gave them a hint, or it may have been their own thought. Hector answered, I have not forgotten all that, my wife. But I could not show my face before the men or the women of Troy if I skulk like a coward out of the way. And I will not do it, for I have learned how to bear myself bravely in the front of the battle and to win credit for my father and myself. One thing I know indeed in my heart and soul. A day shall come when sacred Troy shall perish, and Priam and the people of Priam. But my sorrow is not so much for what will happen to the people, or Queen Hecabe herself, or King Priam, or my brothers, when all those good men and true shall fall in the dust before their enemies. As for you, when some armed man shall drive you away weeping, and take from you the day of freedom, to think that you should live in a foreign land and ply the loom at the orders of another woman, that you should carry water from strange fountains, crushed under stern necessity, a hateful task. That someone should see you shedding tears and say, there is Hector's wife, and he was the first and best of the brave Trojans when there was that war about Troy. And he will make your pain ever fresh, while there is no such man to save you from the day of slavery. May I be dead and buried deep in the earth before I hear your cries and see you dragged away. As he spoke, Hector held out his arms for his boy, but the boy shrank back into the nurse's bosom, crying and scared at the sight of his father, for he was afraid of the gleaming metal and the horsehair crest when he saw that dreadful thing nodding from the top of the helmet. Father and mother laughed aloud, and Hector took off the helmet and set it down on the ground, shining and flashing. Then he kissed his son and dandled him in his hands, and prayed aloud to heaven. O Zeus and all ye heavenly gods, grant that this my son may be as notable among our people as I am, and let him be as strong, and let him rule Ilios in his strength. When he goes to war, let them say, this man is much better than his father. May he kill his enemy and bring home the blood-stained spoils and give joy to his mother's heart. Then he gave his boy back into the mother's arms, and she pressed him to her sweet-scented breast, laughing through the tears. Her husband was moved with pity as he saw this. He stroked her with his hand and said, my dearest, do not grieve too much. No man will send me to my grave unless it be so ordained. But destiny is a thing which no man can escape, neither coward nor brave man, from the day he is born. Go home now and see to your own household work, the loom and the distaff, and keep your servants to their tasks. War shall be men's business, and mine especially of all those who are in Ilios. Then Hector took up the helmet with its nodding crest. But his wife went on her way home, turning again and again to look as the tears flowed thick and fast. And when she got to her house, all the women fell a-weeping too. They mourned for Hector in his own house while he still lived, for they never thought he would escape his enemies and return from the battle again. Paris made no delay either. As soon as his armor was on, he hurried through the city at the top of his speed. He was like a stallion after a good feed at the manger, who breaks his halter and runs whinnying over the plain to his usual bath in the river. He bears himself proudly, arches his neck, the mane shakes over his shoulders. He knows his own fine looks as he gallops along to the place where the mares graze. Such was Paris Priamides as he marched down from Pergamon in armor shining like the sun, chuckling with glee as his quick feet ran. He caught up his brother just as he was leaving the place where the two loving hearts had spoken. Paris at once said, "Well, your worship, you see what a drag I am on you when you are in a hurry. I'm late, and I did not come along fair and square as you told me." Hector said, "My good fellow, no fair-minded man could despise your work in battle, for you fight well. But you do not really want to fight, and you are glad to hang back. What I regret is that I hear people speak ill of you, when all their hardships are borne for your sake. But let us go on. We will satisfy them by and by. If Zeus ever grant us to set up a bowl of deliverance in our hall in gratitude to the deathless gods of heaven, when we have driven the enemy host away from Troy." Book 7. How Aias and Hector fought in single combat, and how the Trojans sent a herald to propose peace. Hector now sallied forth from the gates, and his brother Alexandros with him, both full of ardor for the battle. The sight of them was as welcome to the Trojan host as a fair wind when God is pleased to send it for sailors who are weary and worn out with rowing over the sea. Then Alexandros killed Menestheus, whose father was Eurystheus, the bludgeon man, and his father Philomedusa. His home was in Arne. Hector struck Eunios on the neck under the helmet and brought him down. Glaucus the Lycian ran his spear through the shoulder of Iphinous Dexiades. As he was mounting his chariot, he fell to the ground and moved no more. But when Athena saw her friends falling thus, she shot down from Olympus. Apollo saw her come and issued out of the citadel to help his Trojans. The two met by the oak tree, and Apollo called out, "Why are you here again, you daughter of Zeus, in all this excitement? Why has your hot temper brought you from Olympus? Do you want to turn the battle and give the victory to your Danians? You have no pity when Trojans fall. But listen to me, and I will tell you what is best to do. Let us put a stop to fighting for this day. Afterwards they shall fight again, until they make an end of Ilios, for I see you goddesses mean to destroy this city." Athena replied, "So be it, Shutaphar. That was just what I had in mind myself in coming here. Very well, how do you think to stop it?" Apollo said, "Let us move Hector to challenge all comers to single combat. Then the Achaeans will be put on their mettle and send someone to fight Hector." Athena consented, and at once their compact became plain to the mind of Helenos, Priam's son, the diviner. So he said to Hector, "My dear prince, you know a good notion as well as Zeus could himself. Would you listen to me for a moment? I am your brother, you know. Go out yourself and challenge all comers to single combat, and let both armies sit down and look on. For it is not your fate to die now. The voice of the immortal gods has told me so." Hector was delighted when he heard these words. He marched between the armies, holding his spear by the middle of the shaft, and kept back his own battalions. They all sat down, and then Agamemnon made his men do the like. Apollo and Athena, in the form of two vultures, perched upon the tall oak tree and looked on with great enjoyment. The ranks were set close and bristled with shields and helmets and spears, as the waves of the sea ripple and crinkle when the west wind blows it black. Then Hector addressed them all. "Hear me speak, Trojans and Achaeans both, and let me tell you what is in my mind.
Cronides, throned on high, would not let us keep our sworn treaty, but he ordains a hard struggle for us all until either you shall take the castle of Troy, or you shall be vanquished yourselves beside your own ships. Here among you are the greatest men of all the Achaean peoples. Now then, if any one of you has a mind to fight with me, let him come forth and be your champion against Hector. Here is what I propose, and let Zeus be witness on both parts. If that man shall strike me down, let him strip me and take my armor for his spoil. But my body he shall give back to be carried home, that my people may give me dead my portion of fire. But if Apollo grant me success and I strike him down, I will strip off his armor and take it into sacred Troy and hang it before the temple of Apollo Shutafar. But the body I will give back, that his friends may carry it to their camp, to give him funeral and build him a barrow beside the broad Hellespont. Then men will say in far distant generations to come, as they sail along the shore, yonder is the barrow of a man dead long ago, a champion whom famous Hector slew. So my fame will never be forgotten. Silence fell upon all. They were ashamed to refuse, and they feared to accept. But at last Menelaus rose to his feet and cried out loudly in anger and contempt, "Oh, you boasters, you women! I cannot call you men! Here is a stain upon us, a terrible terror of a stain, if not a man will go out to meet Hector. May you all rot into mud and water where you sit, weak and inglorious. I will arm me against this man myself, but the cords of victory are held above by the immortal gods." Then he put on his armor, and then, Menelaus, the end of your life would have come, for Hector was far stronger. Had not the Achaean princes sprung up and laid hold of you, King Agamemnon himself caught his brother by the right hand and cried, "You are mad, Menelaus, and what is the use of madness like that? Hold back, however hard it is, and don't fight a better man than yourself just for a challenge. Everyone dreads Hector Priamides. Even Achilles shudders to meet this man in battle, and he is a much better man than you. Just sit down among your friends, and they will put up another champion for this man. Even if he is fearless and a glutton for a fight, I vow he will be glad to rest his knees if he gets clear out of this battle." He succeeded in changing his brother's mind, for what he said was true, and the servants took off his armor. Then Nestor rose and spoke.
"Look there now! What tribulation has come upon our country and our people! It would make Peleus groan aloud, poor old man. Ah, what a wise man he was! What a good king! I remember well how he enjoyed asking me all about the great men of our people, who were their fathers and who were their sons. If he could hear about them now, all trembling before Hector, how he would lift up his hands to heaven and pray that his soul might leave his body and go down to Hades. O Father Zeus, Athena, Apollo, if I were young and strong now, as I was, when Pelians and Arcadians gathered and fought beside the swift river of Celadon before the walls of Phaia, about the stream of Iardanus, on the other side stood their champion, Eurythalion. A grand fellow he was, and he wore the armor of King Areithous, the glorious Areithous, a name of note among men and women. They called him the Bludgeon Man, because he fought not with bow or spear, but with an iron bludgeon, which broke up the battalions. Lycurgus killed him. He trusted to skill, not to force, and killed him in a narrow lane where his bludgeon could not save his life. Lycurgus got in first and ran him through the middle with his spear, and down he came on his back. The victor took his arms, which were the gift of Ares. After that, Lycurgus wore them himself in battle. But when he grew old, he gave them to Eurythalion, his faithful squire, and Eurythalion, wearing these, challenged all the best. They were all trembling and affrighted. Not a man would dare. But my daring mind, in its boldness, set me on to fight him, although I was youngest of them all, and fight him I did, and Athena gave me the victory.
That was the biggest and strongest man I ever killed. He covered a great space, sprawling all abroad. If I were only young now, as I was then, if my old strength were still in me, then Hector would soon have a fight. But as for you, the best of all the Achaeans, not one of you is ready to face Hector cheerfully.
At the taunting words, 9 men rose up. First my lord King Agamemnon strode forward. Diomedes followed, then Big Aeus and Little Aeus. After them, Idomeneus and his comrade Meriones, Eurypylus, Eumon's son, Thoas, Andraemon's son, Prince Odysseus himself, all these were ready to fight Hector. To these, Nestor said,
"Cast lots now, all of you, and that shall be the choice. That man will be a blessing to the Achaeans, and he shall have a blessing upon his own spirit if he comes out safe from the dangerous contest."
Then each man put a mark on his lot, and all the lots were thrown into King Agamemnon's helmet. And all the host lifted up their hands to heaven and prayed, "O Father Zeus, let Aeus win the lot, or Diomedes, or the great king of Mycenae himself." Geryneian Nestor shook the helmet, and out jumped the lot which they had prayed for, the lot of Aeus. A herald carried it round from left to right and displayed it to the champions. Each took a look at it and shook his head. Last of all, it came to Aeus, who held out his hand. And when the lot was dropped in his hand, he knew the mark he had scratched upon it. Great was his joy. He threw the lot down by his foot and called out loudly, "My friends, this is my lot. I am glad indeed, for I think I shall conquer Prince Hector. Come along and let me put on my armor. Then pray, all of you, to Lord Zeus Cronion, quietly by yourselves, that the enemy may not hear, or indeed openly, why not? We fear no man. No one is strong enough to make me run unless I want to run, and no one is clever enough. Greenhorns like that are not born and bred in Salamis." So they all made their prayer to Zeus Cronion. "O Father Zeus, throned upon Ida, most glorious and most great, grant victory to Aeus and high renown. Or if thou lovest Hector and carest for him, grant equal power and equal glory to both." Now Aeus armed himself and made ready. Then he marched out, prodigious like the god of war, when he goes forth to battle among men whom Cronion has pitted against each other in mortal combat. So terrible was that prodigious man, the safeguard of the nation, as he marched with long strides and a smile on his grim face, shaking his long spear. This was a joyful sight for his countrymen, but the Trojans felt their limbs tremble, and Hector's own heart beat fast, but he could not now retreat or disappear among the crowd, since he was the challenger. Aeus came near, holding that great shield like a tower, 7 oxhides with a coating of bronze which had been made for him by Tychios of Hyle, the master armorer, 7 layers of oxhide, I say, the hide of prime bulls, with an 1/8 of bronze. That shield Telamonian Aeus held before his breast as he stood within reach of Hector, and said in threatening tones, "Now, Hector, you shall know, man to man, you alone and I alone, what champions remain among the Danians, even without Achilles' lion-heart, man-breaker. He stays away, nursing his grudge against Agamemnon. But we are left to meet you, and not a few. You begin, sir, and strike first." Hector answered, "Telamonian Aeus, my very good lord, do not tease me as if I were a feeble boy or a woman who knows nothing of the works of war. I tell you that I know well how to fight and how to kill. Round to the right of me, round to the left of me, I know well to handle the buckler, trusty shield of seasoned hide. I know how to charge my chariot into the melee of galloping mares. I know well to tread the war dance when it comes to a stand-up fight. But I don't care to use a sly, furtive shot at a man such as you are. Let the world see if I can hit you." With these words he poised the spear and cast. It struck the great shield full upon the outer bronze, the 8th coat. Through 6 coats the point ran, but held at the 7th. Then Aeus cast his own long spear and struck Hector's round buckler. Right through it went, and through corselet also. The blade cut the tunic on Hector's side, but he swerved and saved his life. Then both pulled out their spears and leapt at each other like a couple of lions or wild boars. Hector struck the middle of the great shield, but he did not pierce the metal, and the point was bent. Then Aeus, with a leap, pierced the round buckler. The blade went through and cut the neck so that the red blood bubbled up, and Hector staggered back. But Hector was not finished yet. He moved back a pace or two and picked up a stone lying on the ground, black, big, and ragged. This he threw and struck the great shield on the boss till the metal rang again. Aeus followed up with a still larger stone, swung it round his head, and cast it with all his might. This great millstone smashed the round buckler inwards, and brought the man down. He fell on his back, huddled under the buckler, but Apollo set him on his feet again. And now they would have been hard at it, cut and thrust with swords. But suddenly the two heralds came forward, Talthybius from the Trojan side, Idaeus from the Argives, who knew well their duty as spokesmen.